The American History Podcast, Episode 9, Southern Culture.
Welcome to the American History Podcast. Hosted by Sean Worswick.
Okay, so welcome back. Seems like we're back on our regular schedule, or so I hope. I also hope that you're excited by this just as much as I am. I've really enjoyed doing this show and bringing you some information about American history that perhaps you didn't learn in school. Busting the myths of American history is what we do here, and I truly thank you all for listening, all 10 of you. Okay, there's maybe 12. But before we get started, please go to the website, www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com, and vote in our poll. I'm going to be closing it tomorrow. Today is the 12th of December, so you've got all day today. I'm trying to figure out what topic we will cover in Season 2. Your choices are, number one, the American War for Independence, number two, the Cold War, number three, the Vietnam War, and number four, the War with Mexico. We are going to close it tomorrow, like I said, so please get out there and vote. There are literally thousands of you that are listening to this podcast, all joking aside from a moment ago, which I find truly hard to believe, and it will only take you a minute to vote, so please help me out with that. It's greatly appreciated. Also, while you're on the website, please sign up for our email updates. I promise you I don't send out a bunch of emails. Actually, I only send an email when I publish a new episode, so you don't need to worry about me emailing you 200 emails per day. And finally, if you can, please give us a like. Please give us a positive review on iTunes. That really helps other interested listeners find us. Okay, so today's topic is Southern culture. And I think this is one that you're going to find informative and fascinating. Really, when it comes to America, the South is extremely important. I can't overemphasize how important it is. So this is going to really give us a good idea as to what makes America, America. To understand America, you really need to understand the South. And what groups make up the South? Southerners are truly a mixture of three different cultures. The Cavaliers, whom we've mentioned in Episode 7, did a little bit of talk on them, along with the African culture and then the Celtic culture. Now, if you remember, the Cavaliers dominated Southern political and social life, but as you moved away from the coastal areas and into the frontier, you would have found that the Celts had a greater amount of influence there, and so that's what we're going to talk about. Cavalier culture dominates the low areas along the coast, while the Celtic culture dominates in the quote-unquote backwoods region. And so that brings up the question, who were the Celts? Basically, the Celts came from northern Britain, Ireland, and Scotland. They did not come over all at once, but they came in waves, and they came in fairly large numbers, and they would continue to come over up through the 18th century. Now, the first wave, if you want to call it that, took place, as historian David Hackett Fisher noted in his excellent book, Albion Seed. That first wave came over in the fall, summer, fall of 1717. He also notes that this movement was very large, more than 250,000 people altogether. And it was different in that it drew from a different part of Britain, the aforementioned territories, which actually bordered the Irish Sea. Some might refer to them as the borderlands. So why did they come? For the most part, they came over with the hopes of bettering themselves materially. They had it kind of tough in the British Isles. Land was not readily available and certainly not cheap. And they hoped that they could come over and make a new life for themselves. Having said that, they were from a mixture of different social classes. Not all of them were from the bottom rung of society, as you might suspect. They weren't all Catholic either. They were a mixture of different Christian denominations, whether that's Protestant or Catholic. Now, if you had to pick, you would say they were Presbyterian. And finally, these people tended to settle, as we said, in the backcountry of America. In other words, the mountains. And it was the backcountry which ended up producing some of the most famous Americans in history. People like Andrew Jackson, James K. Polk, John C. Calhoun, Patrick Henry, Sam Houston, Dolly Parton. Okay, all of these people came from the backcountry. Now, they got here, obviously, via ship, and they mostly entered through the port of Philadelphia. From there, they would move, or they moved into the surrounding countryside, squatting on any vacant land that they could find. The Quakers, who were already living in the region, I can assure you weren't too happy about this invasion of newcomers. One resident at the time referred to them as audacious and disorderly. Another wrote, quote, "I must own from my own experience in the land office that the settlement of five families from Ireland gives me more trouble than 50 of any other people." It should also be noted that these newcomers brought with them the ancient border habit of belligerence towards other ethnic groups. So we've touched a little bit on their social makeup, but let's go deeper for just a moment. This group of people was not simply made up of one social class, as we already said. There were those who believed, as did one Anglican priest, that these immigrants were, the scum of the two nations, end quote. Others believed they were of the middle class. And essentially, both are right. It was a truly mixed group. A small but certainly important minority were from the Irish and Northern British gentry, but they were no more than 2% of the total. The majority of these people were from the ranks below that of the gentry and the statesmen. Many of these people were farmers and farm workers who owned no land of their own and simply wanted to better themselves. Finally, a few of them came in bondage, but very, very few. Indentured servants were a distinct minority in this group. So keeping that in mind, let's discuss what Fisher refers to as the speech ways, the way people talk. Now here in the United States, you can hear a distinctive family of regional dialects. For example, there's a difference between the dialects of Ozark and the Appalachian Mountains compared to, let's say, the lower Mississippi Valley. Differences again between, say, Texas and the Southern Plains. Fisher notes that the American way of speech is at least 200 years old and was recognized as early as the years before the War of Independence. Now, at this point, it would have been referred to as Scotch-Irish speech, and it came to dominate the area as other ethnic groups would adopt it as their own. And we're talking about the backcountry. Some examples of this Scotch-Irish speech, which is similar to the language spoken today in the Southern Highlands, has become familiar as the English of, say, country western singers, truck drivers, your film cowboys, your backcountry politicians. And so what do I mean? Well, they say war for where, thar for there, hard for hired, critter for creature, sartin for certain, a goin for goin, or going. You can tell I'm from Texas. Hit for it, he it for hit, far for fire, deef for deaf, pizen for poison, naked for naked, each for itch, bush for bush, wrassle for wrestle, and chaw for chew. And so those are just some examples. In grammar, they also differed in many ways from other English dialects. One example is in the verb construction, such as he come in, she done finished, they growed up, the plural, they is judged, the interrogative, you wasn't there, was you, the emphatic, he done did it, and the use of who've as a past participle of heave. They also had some distinctive words such as fornenst, next to, skift for a dusting of snow, fixin means you're getting ready to do something, nigh is near, if you're letting on, you're pretending, and honey is a term of endearment. Now we've got the marriage ways. Now the marriage ways are interesting in that you had voluntary and involuntary marriage abduction. And this was, believe it or not, a very old custom in the English, Irish, and Scottish border countries, one that had been elaborately regulated through the centuries by folk laws requiring payment of a body price and honor price. And so, like I said, there's two types of abduction, the voluntary, which is where the bride willingly goes, but without her family's prior consent, And then there's involuntary, of course, which is without the bride's consent. Now, this custom would make its way into the American backcountry, just as the language and whatnot came with the people. And even future President Andrew Jackson took his wife through an act of voluntary abduction. Now, of course, the problem was that Rachel was unhappily married to another man at the time. Now, whether or not she was happily or unhappily is beside the point. She was married. So a series of quarrels ensues until Rachel Robards makes her own preferences clear, and then Jackson threatened her husband that he would, quote, cut off his ears, at which point Jackson was arrested. While the case was awaiting trial, Jackson takes it upon himself to chase down Robards, butcher knife in hand, at which point Robards fled the area. I guess at that point he realizes Jackson wasn't kidding about cutting his ears out of his head. Thus, the trial never takes place. After all, you need a plaintiff. And with the case being dismissed, Jackson married Rachel. Now, these weddings could often include shooting, drinking, kissing, dancing. In other words, this is kind of a wild party. And they lasted for days. A custom that we might recognize to some extent was the wedding toast. After dinner, each of the male guests raised a bottle in his right hand and exclaimed, "Here's to the bride, thumping luck and big children." Now, I'm not sure about thumping luck, what that's all about, but it's pretty obvious that big children, especially boys, was what most families needed. This was, after all, a highly warlike society, one in which perpetual warfare with the Native Americans was taking place. There was no end in sight to this violence, and so having big boys would be something you'd want. But this also gives us some insight in not only to their wedding customs, but into the gender relationships in the backcountry. Men were warriors. Women were workers. And of course, these ideas would have come from the borderlands of Britain. Now, child rearing, which is kind of related to the marriage, was all about building up the will of your child. Boys, it was thought, should have fierce pride, stubborn independence, and the courage of a warrior. All children in the South, in general, would have had immense freedom. Girls were expected to be industrious, obedient, patient, devoted to others. Andrew Jackson is again another good example for us to observe. He would remember his youth as one in which he was, quote, wild, frolicsome, mischievous, daring, and reckless, end quote. His upbringing made him someone who was quick to take offense and with a temper that was explosive. When he was a young militiaman, he was described as fearless and bold, everything you would want in a young man who was born into a militant culture. Now, once a boy put on his first pair of pants, he followed his parents around, and he was allowed a great deal of freedom on the farm. Further, at an early age, males were given their own miniature weapons. So you might get a hatchet, a knife, a bow, even maybe a toy gun, so to speak. Now, while corporal punishment was condemned in the abstract, there are numerous autobiographies of backcountry folk who remember terrific beatings being dished out by frustrated parents unable to control their children or incapable of controlling their own rage. Now, in the South, religious ways also included an intense hostility, if I can say that right, to organized churches and the clergy. But there was a genuine interest in religion. In the backcountry, most people were Presbyterian, and oftentimes you had churches that would meet in tents. Now, the aforementioned Fisher refers to them as militant Christians. While most were Presbyterian, you also had Anglicans and a smattering of Catholics amongst the immigrants. The two Protestant denominations, Anglican and Presbyterian, would have shown a strong tendency towards what is referred to as New Light Christianity. We will discuss the New Lights when we get into New England, but for now, suffice it to say that they believed in, quote, free grace, end quote, and held prayer meetings and created prayer societies, a custom which they carried with them into the backcountry of the North American continent. When it comes to names, these folks did not, in general, adopt high-toned royalist names. In Appalachia, a lot of the place names, for example, came from the geography of Britain. You get the most common name in the region being Cumberland, a British county in the extreme northwestern portion. of England. And so there was a Cumberland, Maine, a Cumberland River in Tennessee, the Cumberland Mountains in Kentucky, and Cumberland Knob in North Carolina. Speaking of North Carolina, you'll find in that state a Galloway Creek, Galloway Crossroads, Galloway Mountain, and a Galloway Town. And you've actually find numerous instances of Durham being used. One of the interesting naming conventions is how many of the backcountry places reflected other aspects of border culture, especially foodways. So some examples include place names such as Clabber Branch, Frying Pan, Corn Cake, Whiskey Springs, and Hangover Creek. I don't think I'd like to live in Hangover Creek myself. Places not only reflected their culture, their food culture, but also the outlook that people had on life. Some examples are Hard Bargain Branch, Lousy Creek, Worry, Noland, Big Trouble, Hell's Half Acre, and Devil's Tater Patch. That latter one seems to be the place I used to work at. Speaking of food, the diet here differed from, say, the areas where the Cavaliers were prevalent. The standard dish for supper in the mid-18th century in this area was a wooden bowl of milk and mush, seasoned with a splash of bear oil. I have no idea what that's all about. An Anglican missionary to the backcountry complained incessantly about what they fed him. Quote, clabber, butter, fatty, mushy bacon, cornbread as for tea and coffee, they know it not. Neither beef nor mutton nor beer, cider or anything better than water, end quote. I would have been upset because I love my iced tea. One noted that these people lived on what in England was given to hogs. Common food was boiled, and oddly, it was believed that dirt was needed for your meal to be good. They had a saying, the more hair in the butter, the better. The more dirt, the less hurt. I think I would pass on that myself. Last but not least, you have their beliefs on power and liberty. In general, Southerners believed in personal government. It was your job to look after yourself. They believed in strong personal leadership. They often lived in small communities which were made up of members of the same clan. They believed in natural freedom and the natural law ideas of, say, John Locke. For the most part, they shunned authority. They did not believe in law and order being handed down from a central authority. Remember, they believed in personal government, so they saw no need for that central power. This would mean that in the South, most, if not all, believed in the idea of minimal government, light taxes, for example. They also felt it was their responsibility to arm themselves to protect against tyranny, whether that was local or from some outside source. Okay, so that gives you an idea of the culture of the backwoods Americans. Before we go, there are some great books on this subject, two of which are Grady McWinney and Forrest McDonald's book, Cracker Culture, Celtic Ways in the Old South, published by the University of Alabama Press in the 1980s. Another great work is one that I've already mentioned several times, David Hackett Fisher's Albion's Seed. Those are really some excellent works and a good place for you to start. So once again, please go to the website, www.theamericanhistorypodcast.com. Take our poll, sign up for the email. If you are looking for me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at AmericanHisCast. It's supposed to be American History Podcast, but it wouldn't fit. So at AmericanHisCast. And I'm not on Facebook, really. I'm not a big Facebook fan. But please sign up for our email, go do our poll, follow me on Twitter, and I should have another episode out here pretty soon. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good day.